The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the programs, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, we have a lot to get to on today's program. Later on in the show, we're going to get into a Bible study on the subject of being a dependable worker in serving God and Jesus Christ above all, of course. But we'll look at some scriptures about just being more of a self-starter and able to work and to produce even when there isn't or won't always be direct supervision over you, at least in the flesh. Of course, as we know, the Bible says that God is always watching. He's always observing. So we'll look at that later on, as I say. We'll also be talking today about President Obama's legacy. He's coming up to the end of his second term. We'll look at that. We'll also look at Donald Trump's new plan to make socialism great again. How about that? And then also we'll be touching on Ronald Reagan again, but with a little bit of a twist. When he became president early on in his administration in the 1980s, he placed a portrait in the cabinet room of the White House. Who could that be? Who was on that portrait? We'll look at that coming up in the next segment. Let's begin, though, by talking about President Obama's legacy. Almost 8 years of it now. Of course, he stormed into office 8 years ago, promising to fundamentally transform the United States of America. And on that promise, He's pretty well kept his word. He's followed through. The Washington Examiner from a couple of days ago, it says here the Bill of Rights is a barricade protecting Americans from their government. Part of President Obama's legacy will be that he inflicted damage on the barricade, eroding freedom of speech, free exercise of religion, the right to bear arms, and the right to due process. And that's what this article, a fairly lengthy one, goes through. We won't go through much of it, or at least those four sections that are brought out there. But it says here at the start, through his political arguments, executive actions, and political leadership, Obama has taken some of the holes punched by previous presidents and made them broader and more permanent. This means that after Obama leaves office, people will be more easily silenced, killed, or disarmed by their own government. This is in the United States, the land of freedom and liberty. It says Obama is leaving behind a public less protected from state power. And then, as I say, he goes on to detail in with quite a lot of examples many of the freedoms that have eroded away during the last 7.5 years or so. Freedoms in speech and politics speech in politics and on campus, as it says later on, the free exercise of religion. Also, of course, the attack on the Second Amendment. And let me just sum up here what he says at the end. The president and his 2009 inaugural address promised to take up the task of remaking America. The Bill of Rights, as a barricade creating a sphere of freedom from government intrusion, has always been an essential part of America. President Obama has, in fact, remade the Bill of Rights. He leaves that sphere of freedom a bit smaller, and he leaves America diminished and more easily intimidated. And so when you look around the United States today, you see those freedoms diminishing. And there's really no politician or even political party that standing up in defense of those freedoms enshrined in the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, Victor Davis Hanson, he has a piece, I think, today at National Review, The Legacies of Barack Obama, and he writes here, what is going on in Obama's home stretch? And basically at the start, he talks about how little this this president has accomplished with respect to, you know, policies and things of that nature. And so that he's going to be known more for things he's destroyed and, of course, his inflammatory rhetoric. But it says later on in the article, apparently Obama is veering even further to the left in hopes of establishing a rhetorical progressive legacy in lieu of any lasting legislative or foreign policy achievement. Turning the presidency into an edgy soapbox is seemingly all that is left of Obama's promise to fundamentally transform the country. Well, I think there's more to it than just the rhetoric. There really has, as the previous article brings out. There's been a lot of destruction over these past 7.5 years. There's been an assault on the Bill of Rights, on the freedoms, the liberties that Americans have enjoyed. It says, but divisive sermonizing and the issue of executive orders are not the same as successfully reforming our healthcare system. It says the Affordable Care Act, born of exaggeration and untruth, is now in peril as insurers pull out and the costs of premiums and deductibles soar. So that program's in trouble, Hanson believes. It says even presidential nominee and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is not really defending the Obama administration's past red line in Syria. The reset with Vladimir Putin's Russia, we talked some on that yesterday, of course. The bombing of Libya, it says, the Benghazi tragedy, the euphemistic rebranding of Islamic terrorism as mere violent extremism, the abrupt pullout from and the subsequent collapse of Iraq, or the Iran nuclear deal that so far seems to have made the theocracy both rich and emboldened. He says the U.S. economy, with its record low growth over 8 years, near record labor non-participation rates, record national debt, and record consecutive years of zero interest rates, is not much of a legacy either. I mean, it's just all going down. Never mind what the administration says about how great everything is 8 years on. These are the facts. This is reality. Look at how many are no longer even in the workforce. Look at how many are receiving handouts from the government. How much longer can it last? We'll get into that a little bit more in just a second. Hanson says racial relations in this country seem as bad as they've been in a half century. Given the scandal involving Hillary Clinton's use of a private, unsecured email server for official State Department communications, the politicization of the IRS, the messes at the GSA and VA, and the current ethical confusion at the FBI and Justice Department over Clinton's violations, Obama has not made good on his promise of a transparent, efficient, and honest government. He concludes then, what then is the presidential legacy of Barack Obama? It won't be found in either foreign or domestic policy accomplishment. More likely, he'll be viewed as an outspoken progressive who left office loudly in the same manner that he entered it, as a critic of the culture and country in which he has thrived. You see, just criticizing and running down the institutions of the United States, what it was founded on, fundamentally transform it all. He says, but there may be another unspoken legacy of Obama, and it is his creation of the candidacy of Donald Trump. Trump is running as an angry populist, fueled by the promise that whatever supposed elites such as Obama have done to the country, he will largely undo. That's what he's been saying this past year, particularly in the primary season. He's going to undo all that President Obama has ruined. He's going to fix everything that's been ruined. Hansen says Obama's only legacy seems to be that hope and change begat Make America Great Again. And so, well, if you follow this thinking, assuming Donald Trump is elected in November, you have to ask, though, with respect to his vow or his promise to undo all of this, how much does a President Trump actually want to undo? How much can he even undo in the first place? But that's, of course, assuming he really does want to undo it. As we have learned this week, a Trump administration is proposing more government handouts, more government spending, more entitlement programs. This is coming from the so-called conservative wing of American politics. 6 weeks of mandatory paid by the taxpayers maternity leave. Paid by you. 6 weeks, mandatory. And he's calling on the government also to subsidize out-of-home child care. Now, these are the kinds of government-funded programs that the Democrats are always out there proposing. These are the kinds of programs that come straight out of the socialist playbook. And there's not very many conservatives that are even speaking out about it. You can maybe count them on one hand. Here's one of them, Charles Krauthammer. He said this yesterday on Fox News.
Trump himself is the one who brings up the deficit and the debt all the time as a sign of our decline, as a sign of having government out of control and having incompetence in government. Look, I think this raises the question of how many Democratic parties does the country need? We already have one. And I thought during the primary season, the argument for Trump was he was a guy who would stand up to the Washington Republican sold-out establishment that refused to stand up to Barack Obama on higher spending, refused to stand up to him on entitlements, refused to stand up to him on executive actions. And therefore, we needed an outsider, a disruptor named Donald Trump, who would not do this. What he is proposing is to out-Democrats the Democrats. This is an enormous new entitlement. It will blow the debt. And when he says the mandate, he's going to mandate from Washington. Isn't that the one thing that Republicans all agree upon, of the government stepping in and telling private industry what to do? He says that will be paid for by taking out waste, fraud, and abuse from the unemployment insurance system. If you believe that, you will believe anything.
If you believe that, you'll believe anything. This is an enormous new entitlement program that's just going to blow the lid off of the debt. This, as one commentator wrote, is an effort to make socialism great again. Now, you've got a lot of people in the Republican Party, because they're all in on Trump, no matter what he says, that are defending this by saying, well, it's good for families. And in fact, it's anti-family, as nearly every government program is. It's anti-family all the way through. It gives the government more control over children, not less, more. That's the reality. And yet there's just fewer and fewer people who are willing to put their careers on the line to tell you the truth. It's all about making the dollars. It's all about getting advertisers for your programs. It's all about making sure you hold on to your audience, your ratings. That's what it's all built around for so many. And meanwhile, these programs hurt everyday Americans. They hurt the family, the traditional family unit. They're not good for children. They're not good for fathers or mothers. And of course, the bottom line, economically, is the United States doesn't have the money to spend on these programs. This is a clip from yesterday. Again, this is a well-known commentator, Rush Limbaugh, one of the best known, I suppose. This is what he said about these entitlement programs that Trump is introducing.
I mean, let me ask you point blank. Do you think the argument over big versus small government's still going on? Or do you think it's over? And if you think it's over, who won? How many people do you know whose vote is predicated largely or maybe totally on which candidate swears to get government out of as much of life as possible? And who is that candidate? I would maintain to you that in this cycle, we have two candidates representing two major parties, neither of which is conservative.
Now, that's Rush Limbaugh, the best-known conservative commentator on talk radio, yesterday walking the tightrope, saying, you know, in one sense, it sounds like he's criticizing what Mr. Trump is doing, but on the other hand, he's on board with it. And we've got to put someone out there that's better than Hillary Clinton. And after all, I mean, really, this decades-long struggle, big government versus small government, is that still going on? And if not, who won? Who's winning? When you've basically got two Democrat parties. Now, those are the two main parties in the United States. And as Krauthammer said, you have the Republican candidate trying to out-Democrats the Democrats. Spend, spend, spend. George Bush comes in with a $5 trillion debt. And he pushes it up to $9 trillion and then hands it over to President Obama, who takes it from $9 trillion to over $19 trillion. That's the course that we're on. We double it every 8 years, and there's no sign that it's ever going to be brought back under control. Mr. Limbaugh said yesterday, I'm the last person on earth who wants any expansion of the government, but I'm also the first person on earth to understand that we have a mess in childcare because of government and because of the left. So, as so many are saying in the Republican wing, if you can't beat them, join them. And, well, if the handouts are going to the illegals and going to the deadbeats, why shouldn't some of those handouts come to the conservatives or the working class? Why shouldn't we all get some of this, a piece of the pie? Meanwhile, the nanny state just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Robert Morley had an article in March earlier this year saying that 153 million people in the United States, that's about half the nation, 153 million receive some form of government benefit. They're on the dole. They're on the dole. Mr. Morley said, with so many Americans taking benefits, two-thirds of every dollar the government spends goes to these mandatory social programs. And that's what the candidate Trump proposed or announced on Tuesday night, more mandatory social programs. And what is it doing to the United States? These are enormous entitlement programs. And once you start them, you can't stop them. You can't do away with them. As President Reagan once said, I think this paraphrases what he said, it's the closest thing we have to eternal life, a new government program, because once it starts, it never stops. It just goes on and on, and it gets bigger, too. It gets bigger. That's what America's turned into, a huge socialist nanny state with a majority of people on the dole, with tens of millions of people on food stamps, with 100 million that are out of the workforce, and an economy that's, well, just getting that much closer to the point of total collapse. Total collapse. I mentioned the testimony of Lawrence Kotlikoff on a program or two earlier this year. This was from back in February of 2015, a year and a half ago now, where he testified and told congressional representatives that our country's broke. Our country's broke. That's how he started his testimony, this economist. This was before the Senate Budget Committee. And he said, I want to get right to the point. It's broke. It's not broke in 75 years. It's not broke in 50 years or 25 years or 10 years. It's broke today. It's broke now. He said, indeed, it may well be in worse fiscal shape than any developed country, including Greece. Including Greece. Unfortunately, the federal debt is not an economic measure of anything, including our nation's fiscal position, he said. Instead, the federal... Well, further on, he says here about Congress cooking the books. Congress's economically arbitrary decisions as to what to put on and what to keep off the books have not been innocent. Successive Congresses, whether dominated by Republicans or Democrats, have spent the post-war accumulating massive net fiscal obligations, virtually all of which have been kept off the books. You see, they cook the books, and it doesn't matter whether it's Republicans or Democrats. And Donald Trump is certainly proving this out. Spending six decades raising or extending transfer payments and cutting or limiting taxes helped members of Congress get reelected, but it has placed our children and grandchildren under a fiscal sword of Damocles that gravely endangers their economic futures. He talked about the fiscal gap amounting to more than $200 trillion. That's when you add all of the unfunded liabilities that we have. And the thing he said before that committee, this is the Senate Budget Committee, is that any one of you members of Congress could figure this out, could punch in these numbers, and come to this same conclusion in 5 minutes. In 5 minutes you could do it, if you were honest. Get in front of your computer, open up an Excel spreadsheet, and you could figure this out. Everyone should be able to see it. But instead of seeing it, they turn a blind eye to it. Worse than that, they lie about it. They cook the books. And then come along and tell the American people, hey, the economy's in better shape than it's ever been. And now the pressure is so intense that you have some of the best known conservative voices saying, look, we've been battling for 30 years on this. Small government, that's what Reagan would have wanted. But where have we gotten with this argument? What has it accomplished for us? And after all, I mean, what Trump's considering, isn't it going to somehow help the family? Of course, it's not going to help the family. When has a government program actually helped the traditional family? We, as I covered on Tuesday's program, we're witnessing a cultural collapse of epic proportions. And so a conservative commentator comes along and says, look, I'm the last person that wants bigger government, but, you know, the liberals have made a mess of things, so we've got to spend more money to try to fix it. Is this going to fix it? Will this solve the problem? You know the answer to that. It never does. Proverbs 14:12, there's a way which seems right to a man, and the end thereof are the ways of death. And so the problem gets worse. And this is if we have a President Trump to just focus on the economy for a moment. You want to know what would be even worse than President Trump's proposals? Hillary Clinton. You've got two Democrats' parties. As Krauthammer said there. And if a Republican, by the way, thinks he's going to out Democrats, the Democrats, well, we'll see what happens. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, he said, this is why this is important. He said that a massive financial crisis centered in America is what would accelerate these many Bible prophecies regarding the beast power to come out of Europe. The formation of the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And he said, if you look back at his writings in 1984, 1985, just before he died, he said that this economic collapse would come suddenly, and that it would trigger all sorts of other events prophesied in your Bible. There's a proverb that says, where there's no vision, the people perish. Shame on so-called conservatives who've now given up because of what? Well, we're outnumbered. Or, well, nobody cares about big government anymore. And so the truth, once again, is sacrificed. And God's word says, if we don't have enough vision to see where this is leading, then we're going to perish. Our children will perish. Our grandchildren will perish. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG.FM. If you're listening online, email the show at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
So when Ronald Reagan became president of the United States back in 1981, he and his wife were working to redecorate a few of the rooms inside of the White House. And in doing that, Mr. Reagan decided to hang a picture of, or a portrait of, Calvin Coolidge in the cabinet room there at the White House. And some of President Reagan's aides thought, well, why Calvin Coolidge? And when was he president again? Well, he was president back in the 1920s. He was known as Silent Cal because of how quiet and introverted he was. In fact, there is one story about just how quiet he was, how little he talked, in fact, that at one dinner party, a woman approached him and said she had made a bet with her friend that she could get him to say more than two words to her, and Coolidge looked at her and smiled and said, "You lose." So he had a good sense of humor, in addition to being quiet and introverted. And what got me into this earlier this morning, in fact, was my brother-in-law, Joel Hilliker. He sent me this speech that President Coolidge gave back in 1926. So now, because thanks to your wonderful host of Trumpet Hour, I have another U.S. president that I need to study up on. I'll be ordering a book or two on Mr. Coolidge, because from what I was able to skim through this morning, including the speech that Joel Hilliker sent to me last night, I definitely want to do a little bit more reading on President Coolidge's leadership. He, in some circles, is seen as the forefather of conservatism. And Reagan, President Reagan, back in the 1980s, he really did admire Coolidge, and he said in his autobiography that he felt like Calvin Coolidge was one of our most underrated presidents. He said this: "Coolidge wasn't a man with flamboyant looks or style, but he got things done in a quiet way. He came into office after World War I facing a momentous war debt, but instead of raising taxes, he cut the tax rate, and government revenues increased, permitting him to eliminate the wartime debt." If some of those policies sound familiar, well, I mean, that's what President Reagan came into office promising to do. The only thing he couldn't do was eliminate debt. Every budget proposal he submitted to Congress, the Democratic-controlled Congress, was rejected. And even many of President Reagan's top aides fought him over his policies, or the policies he wanted, like a 10% across-the-board reduction in spending so that they could rebuild the military. But Reagan did come through and follow through on his promise to reduce taxes. And these were policies that President Coolidge put in place back in the 1920s. And he had even more success. Looking at it economically, he had more success than even President Reagan did. Heritage Foundation has an essay at its website titled "Calvin Coolidge, the Forefather of Our Conservatism." And there's a great section here in this piece on the economy back in the 1920s. I forget the exact years. I think it might be on one of these previous pages. He was vice president first from 1921 to 1923, and then president from 23 to 29. So that gives you the time frame here. But it says here in this Heritage Foundation piece, "Coolidge put his actions behind his rhetoric. He followed his principles as president and was remarkably successful in achieving his policy goals. Harding and Coolidge inherited one of the worst economic disasters in American history. So he was vice president, serving under President Harding. It says in 1921, the unemployment rate was 11.7%. The national debt had shot up from $1.5 billion in 1916 to $24 billion in 1919. A lot of that was brought on because of the cost for World War I. It says gross national product decreased from $91 billion in 1920 to $69 billion in 1921. In response, Harding and Coolidge did not blame their predecessor Woodrow Wilson for the disaster they inherited. Woodrow Wilson was a radical leftist progressive. And then here comes this much more conservative administration. And what did they do with this disaster that they inherited? Did they come in and say, well, hey, we're going to spend more. Hey, we're going to add some entitlement programs to the mix that really benefit people from our side? It says they went about putting their principles into practice and turning the economy around, and they were extremely effective in doing so. They employed a three-step plan. Here it is. You ready? You ready for how complicated this is? I mean, this is government, after all. These are complex issues. Here was their three-step plan. Cut spending dramatically. Lower taxes. And reduce the burden of regulation. Give people more freedom to work. Give them more liberty. Give them less financial obligations. It says, due to the passage of the Budget and Accounting Act of 1921, Coolidge had a newfound power to propose an annual budget, giving him some influence over spending issues. So it was largely because of him that he at least had the president's role at least had some influence, and it wasn't just all Congress. Coolidge used this power, in his words, in an intensive campaign that he waged unrelentingly against federal spending. Now listen to this. This is unheard of. This is just a little under 100 years ago. Coolidge won his war on federal spending. From 1921 to 1924, federal expenditures were reduced from $5.1 billion to $2.9 billion. He reduced spending 43%. It says here, at the same time, Coolidge worked with Secretary of Treasury Andrew Mellon to pass three successive income tax reduction plans. The purpose of reducing spending, he noted, was to protect the property rights of citizens. A government which lays taxes, this is quoting Coolidge, a government which lays taxes on the people not required by urgent necessity is not a protector of liberty, but an instrument of tyranny. It condemns the citizen to servitude. That's just common sense wisdom that springs from the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence. It says here, freeing the citizen from burdensome taxes was Coolidge's top priority, and under the Revenue Acts of 1921, 1924, and 1926, the highest income tax rate fell from 73%. Wow, 73% coming out of Woodrow Wilson's presidency in 1921 to 24%. In 1929, by reducing spending, Coolidge was able to lower taxes and retire much of the government's debt, which was reduced from $24 billion to $16.9 billion. Can you even believe that? That even happened in the United States? That an administration comes into office, reduces spending by 43%, slashes taxes by as much as 50 or 60%, and actually pays down the government's debt, $24 to $16 billion. What is that? That's like a third. Paying down the debt by a third over the course of a few years because of an administration that came in determined to do these three things: cut spending, lower taxes, and reduce the burden of regulation. This Heritage Foundation piece says, finally, combined with his program of regulatory relief, Coolidge's economic policies produced a period of incredible prosperity. Well, Reagan came in some 55, 60 years later and promptly put a portrait of Coolidge up in the cabinet room there in the White House, and then went to work to cut spending, to lower taxes, to reduce the burden of regulation. And wouldn't you know it, the United States economy did experience several years of incredible growth after his presidency. Speaking of Mr. Reagan, in 1990, I believe it was, he accepted the award, I don't know if I wrote it down, the Calvin Coolidge Distinguished Citizen of the Year Award. He received this back in 1990, and this is what President Reagan had to say.
Upon my entering the White House in 1981, it gave me great pleasure to place President Coolidge's portrait in the cabinet room. President Coolidge's unwavering belief in the Constitution of the United States and the rule of law is a beacon of light for all of us to follow. President Coolidge was born on the 4th of July, 1872, and it was probably providential that he should be president on our country's 150th birthday. At the time of that event, President Coolidge spoke at Independence Hall on the 5th of July, 1926, and his speech was entitled, "The Inspiration of the Declaration of Independence." The truths that Coolidge expressed in the Declaration were very old, but never before had they been adopted by a duly authorized and constituted representative body. It was this uniting of philosophical thought with political action that made the Declaration of Independence the most important civil document in the world. During both of our administrations, I am proud to state there were no wars, a period of low inflation, high prosperity, and the easing of federal controls on business. During President Coolidge's term in office, income taxes were reduced and revenues from taxes increased. This allowed the Coolidge administration to reduce the national debt by about $1 billion a year.
That's President Reagan accepting the Calvin Coolidge Distinguished Citizen of the Year Award back in 1990. Within that little clip, you heard him mention the fact that Coolidge was born on the 4th of July, America's birthday, and he gave that speech in July 5th, 1926, the 150-year anniversary of America's birth, that speech titled Inspiration of the Declaration of Independence. That's the speech that Joel Hilliker sent to me last night, and I did go through that in addition to some of this other material that you've heard about here on this show. But perhaps at another date, we can delve further into that speech. And if you don't want to wait for me, you can probably find it online for yourself. Inspiration of the Declaration of Independence. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
In speaking to our students here at Edstone yesterday, I talked to them about how small the operation is still here at Edstone, and how that we all have to be a committee of one, as they say, and really make sure that we're stepping up and being responsible and working hard, particularly if we're out working on a project or all by ourselves or alone somewhere, to just be mindful of the need to be responsible, to pay attention, to be observant to the needs of others, the needs of the supervisor, the needs of the campus here, and everybody playing their part, bearing one another's burdens, as Paul said in Galatians 6, but also carrying your own weight. I used this example in 1 Samuel 16 with David, who did a lot of work on his own when he was out in the fields by himself. And you know the story about 1 Samuel 16, where Jesse brought all of his sons and thought surely one of the older, perhaps better looking son would be the one chosen by God. And of course, we learn in that chapter that God doesn't look at the height or the stature. He doesn't see men the way men see men. He looks on the heart. Men look at the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. Well, it says in 1 Samuel 16, verse 18, this is a little further into the story, where Saul was looking for an assistant. It says in verse 18, "Then answered one of the servants and said, Behold, I've seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, that is cunning and playing and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Lord is with him." So here toward the end of 1 Samuel 16, we get this wonderful little biographical sketch of a young David, who, as it says there, was a valiant man and a skilled musician, very prudent in matters. And then in verse 19, the next verse, it says, "Wherefore Saul sent messengers unto Jesse and said, Send me David your son, which is with the sheep." And so David was out there with the sheep, spending who knows how many hours per day by himself, doing what? Doing what? Well, I mean, tending to the sheep, okay, but what else? The Bible brings out the fact that he was one who meditated on God's law all through the day. In all of those hours that David spent alone watching the flock, how active was his mind? How sharp was his vision? And then when he was able to, how much time did he put in developing his skills on the harp or with his sling? He was a valiant man, it says. My father wrote this in his book, The Former Prophets, that David later became a friend of Samuel. He didn't shy away from the top leaders of Israel. He wanted to be right there with them because he knew that would help him grow and get to know God the Father better. This was a teenager, and look at the reputation he was building. My father said, "It's amazing what a contrast there is between this man's view and that of David's own family. David's father and brothers had an extremely low view of him. Even after Samuel anointed him, they didn't esteem him highly. They put him right back out with the sheep. But this assistant for Saul, I mean, he knew about David. He knew about David's reputation. And then my father makes this point. Sometimes when a boy is cast aside like that, he'll do almost anything to please his dad. Maybe God worked things out in a way that would motivate David, and in the process, he would learn to see a father, a spiritual father, who would never view him as an outsider or outcast, and would never let him down. Maybe that helped to really motivate David. Whatever the reason, this young man just kept working and making a strong name for himself. He just kept working. He just kept building a solid reputation. He kept working on his relationship with God. He brought God into his work. Now, when you look at the New Testament, and you see the way that Jesus Christ conducted his life, he says in John 5 that, you know, I can't do anything of myself, but what I do, I see the Father do. So he tried to emulate the Father's example. He tried to follow in the Father's footsteps. And what did the Father do? John 5 and verse 17 says, "My Father works," this is Jesus talking, "My Father works hitherto, and I work." We're both workers. We're both workmen. And Christ really did look to the example of his Father, the work ethic of his Father. Later in the chapter, he again says, "I can of my own self do nothing." So he looked to the boss. He wasn't out there just trying to be all original. He looked at the example that was right in front of them. And as I was bringing out to the students here at Edstone, there may be fewer supervisors looking over their shoulder than maybe what they were used to when back home or at headquarters in Edmond. But there nevertheless is an example for them to look at. If their eyes are opened, if they're bringing God into their work, lots of valuable lessons in just looking at these examples in the Bible, King David, the young David, and of course Jesus Christ, and the example that he set, and the way that he went about striving to please God in everything, over and above. That's John 8:29. Let me show you what it says in Philippians chapter 4. This is from the Apostle Paul's writings, the epistle to the brethren at Philippi. Philippians 4, verse 8 is the well-known verse about all of these godly virtues. Paul said, "Whatsoever things are true and honest and just and pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of a good report," he said, "if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. Set your mind on these things, the things above," as Colossians 3 says. Set your mind there. And then verse 9, continuing here in Philippians 4, it says, "Those things which you have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do," it says. Do. These are lessons you've learned. These are lessons you've received. These are instructions you've heard. And you also, by the way, have seen it in the Apostle Paul himself. Now, Paul wasn't always there with them. In fact, you can look back at Philippians 2, the memory verse, verse 12, where it says, "Work out your own salvation in fear and trembling." Work it out. Work it out. There's a verse, I can't see it offhand here, but in chapter 1 of this same book, Philippians, he makes the point about, you know, really bearing down, not just in my presence only. Oh, it's verse 27. This is Philippians 1:27. "Only let your conversation or conduct be as it becomes the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit. I mean, whether I'm there or not, you saw enough. I mean, you saw the example, and you can study into it more yourself. Look at the example of Reagan, which we talked about in the previous segment. Clearly, he came into office having studied the life and the beliefs and the teachings of Calvin Coolidge. Not a flamboyant man, in some cases silent. But he went to work. He accomplished a lot. He didn't come into office, Calvin Coolidge, or President Reagan for that matter, with this lazy, well, I'm just here to be served. Everybody's going to wait on me. I finally made it. It's all about me. There's plenty of leaders in this world that work that way. They think it's all about them. They're narcissists through and through. But Paul says here, Jesus said, look at the example of David. Look, you've heard the instruction. You've received it. Now go and do it. Follow through on these examples that you study. Really learn how to be a very reliable and dependable assistant. Whoever it is that you're assisting, I mean, in the spiritual sense, every single one of us is assisting Jesus Christ. If our heart's in the work, and so we want to be tuned in to our boss in heaven, listening carefully to his instructions, faithfully carrying out his requests, looking for opportunities to help make his job easier, to lighten his load, and making sure in everything that we're eager to communicate with the family of God, with God our Father and Jesus Christ at his right hand. You're listening to Stephen Fleury as we put the finishing touches on yet another Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program. Send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.